"Youch!" Richie cried. His eyes fluttered, then opened wide. "What are you hitting me for, Big Bill? You'll break my glasses. They ain't in very good shape anyway, just in case you didn't notice." "I thought you were dying or something," Bill said. Richie sat up slowly in the street and put a hand to his head. He groaned. "What happened?" And then he remembered. His eyes widened in sudden shock and terror, and he scrambled around on his knees, gasping harshly.
"Don't," Bill said. "It's gone, River Richie. It's gone."
Richie saw the empty street where nothing moved and suddenly burst into tears. Bill looked at him for a moment and then put his arms around Richie and hugged him. Richie clutched at Bill's neck and hugged him back. He wanted to say something clever, something about how Bill should have tried the bullseye and the werewolf, but nothing would come out, nothing except sobs.
"Don't, Richie," Bill said.
Then he burst into tears himself, and they only hugged each other on their knees in the street beside Bill's spilled bike, and their tears made clean streaks down their cheeks, which were sooted with coal dust. Chapter 9. Cleaning Up. 1. Somewhere high over New York State on the afternoon of May 29, 1985, Beverly Rogan begins to laugh again. She stifles it in both hands, afraid someone will think she is crazy, but can't quite stop.
"We laughed a lot back then," she thinks.
"It is something else, another light on in the dark. We were afraid all the time, but we couldn't stop laughing, any more than I can stop now." The guy sitting next to her in the aisle seat is young, long-haired, good-looking. He has given her several appreciative glances since the plane took off in Milwaukee at 2:30, almost 2.5 hours ago now, with a stop in Cleveland and another one in Philly, but has respected her clear desire not to talk. After a couple of conversational gambits to which she has responded with politeness but no more, he opens his tote bag and takes out a Robert Ludlum novel. Now he closes it, holding his place with his finger, and says with some concern, "Everything cool with you?" She nods, trying to make her face serious, and then snorts more laughter. He smiles a little, puzzled, questioning.
"It's nothing," she says, once again trying to be serious, but it's no good. The more she tries to be serious, the more her face wants to crack up.
"Just like the old days. It's just that all at once I realized I didn't know what airline I was on. Only that there was a great big duck on the side." But the thought is too much. She goes off into gales of merry laughter. People look around at her, some frowning.
"Republic," he says.
"Pardon?"
"You are whizzing through the air at 470 miles an hour, courtesy of Republic Airlines. It's on the KYAG folder in the seat pocket."
"KYAG?" He pulls the folder, which does indeed have the Republic logo on the front, out of the pocket. It shows where the emergency exits are, where the flotation devices are, how to use the oxygen masks, how to assume the crash landing position.
"The kiss your ass goodbye folder," he says.
And this time they both burst out laughing.
He really is good looking, she thinks suddenly. It is a fresh thought, somehow clear-eyed, the sort of thought you might expect to have upon waking, when your mind isn't all junked up. He's wearing a pullover sweater and faded jeans. His darkish blonde hair is tied back with a piece of rawhide, and this makes her think of the ponytail she always wore her hair in when she was a kid. She thinks, I bet he's got a nice, polite college boy's cock. Long enough to jazz with, not thick enough to be really arrogant.
She starts to laugh again, totally unable to help it. She realizes she doesn't even have a handkerchief with which to wipe her streaming eyes, and this makes her laugh harder.
You better get yourself under control or the stewardess will throw you off the plane, he says solemnly, and she only shakes her head, laughing. Her sides and her stomach hurt now.
He hands her a clean white handkerchief and she uses it. Somehow this helps her to get it under control finally. She doesn't stop all at once, though. It just sort of tapers off into little hitchings and gaspings. Every now and then she thinks of the big duck on the side of the plane and belches out another little stream of giggles. She passes his handkerchief back after a bit.
Thank you.
Jesus, ma'am, what happened to your hand? He holds it for a moment, concerned. She looks down at it and sees the torn fingernails, the ones she ripped down to the quick, tipping the vanity over on Tom. The memory of doing that hurts more than the fingernails themselves,
and that stops the laughter for good. She takes her hand away from him, but gently. "I slammed it in the car door at the airport," she says, thinking of all the times she has lied about things Tom has done to her, and all the times she lied about the bruises her father put on her. Is this the last time, the last lie? How wonderful that would be, almost too wonderful to be believed. She thinks of a doctor coming in to see a terminal cancer patient and saying, "The x-rays show the tumor is shrinking. We don't have any idea why, but it's happening." "It must have hurt like hell," he says. "I took some aspirin." She opens the in-flight magazine again, although he probably knows she's been through it twice already. "Where are you headed?" She closes the magazine, looks at him, smiles. "You're very nice," she says. "But I don't want to talk, all right?" "All right," he says, smiling back. "But if you want to drink to the big duck on the side of the plane when we get to Boston, I'm buying." "Thank you, but I have another plane to catch." "Boy, was my horoscope ever wrong this morning," he says, and reopens his novel. "But you sound great when you laugh. A guy could fall in love." She opens the magazine again, but finds herself looking at her jagged nails instead of the article on the pleasures of New Orleans. There are purple blood blisters under two of them. In her mind, she hears Tom screaming down the stairwell, "I'll kill you, you bitch! You fucking bitch!" She shivers, cold. A bitch to Tom. A bitch to the seamstresses who goofed up before important shows and took a Beverly Rogen reaming for it. A bitch to her father long before either Tom or the hapless seamstresses became part of their lives. A bitch. You bitch. You fucking bitch. She closes her eyes momentarily. Her foot, cut on a shard of perfume bottle as she fled their bedroom, throbs more than her fingers. Kay gave her a Band-Aid, a pair of shoes, and a check for $1,000, which Beverly cashed promptly at 9 o'clock at the First Bank of Chicago in Water Tower Square. Over Kay's protests, Beverly wrote her own check for $1,000 on a plain sheet of typing paper. "I read once that they have to take a check no matter what it's written on," she told Kay. Her voice seemed to be coming from somewhere else. A radio in another room, maybe. "Someone cashed a check once that was written on an artillery shell. I read that in the Book of Lists, I think." She paused, then laughed uneasily. Kay looked at her soberly, even solemnly. "But I'd cash it fast before Tom thinks to freeze the accounts." Although she doesn't feel tired, she is aware, however, that by now she must be going purely on nerves and Kay's black coffee. The previous night seems like something she must have dreamed. She can remember being followed by three teenaged boys who called and whistled but didn't quite dare come right up to her. She remembers the relief that washed over her when she saw the white fluorescent glow of a 7-Eleven store spilling out onto the sidewalks at an intersection. She went in and let the pimply-faced counterman look down the front of her old blouse and talked him into loaning her 40 cents for the payphone. It wasn't hard, the view being what it was. She called Kay McCall first, dialing from memory. The phone rang a dozen times, and she began to fear that Kay was in New York. Kay's sleepy voice mumbled, "It better be good, whoever you are," just as Beverly was about to hang up. "It's Bev, Kay," she said, hesitated, and then plunged, "I need help." There was a moment of silence, and then Kay spoke again, sounding fully awake now. "Where are you? What happened?" "I'm at a 7-Eleven on the corner of Strayland Avenue and some other street. Kay, I've left Tom." Kay, quick and empathetic and excited, "Good, finally, hooray. I'll come and get you, that son of a bitch, that piece of shit. I'll come and get you in the fucking Mercedes. I'll hire a 40-piece band. I'll take a cab," Bev said, holding the other two dimes in one sweating palm. In the round mirror at the back of the store, she could see the pimply clerk staring at her ass with deep and dreamy concentration. "But you'll have to pay the tab when I get there. I don't have any money, not a cent." "I'll tip the bastard $5, Kay cried. "This is the best fucking news since Nixon resigned. You get your buns over here, girl, and..." She paused, and when she spoke again, her voice was serious and so full of kindness and love that Beverly felt she might weep. "Thank God you finally did it, Bev. I mean that. Thank God." Kay McCall is a former designer who married rich, divorced richer, and discovered feminist politics in 1972, about 3 years before Beverly first met her. At the time of her greatest popularity controversy, she was accused of having embraced feminism after using archaic, chauvinistic laws to take her manufacturer husband for every cent the law would allow her. Bullshit, Kay had once exclaimed to Beverly. The people who say that stuff never had to go to bed with Sam Chakowitz. Two pumps, a tickle, and a squirt. That was old Sammy's motto. The only time he could keep it up for longer than 70 seconds was when he was pulling off in the tub. I didn't cheat him. I just took my combat pay retroactively. She wrote three books, one on feminism and the working woman, one on feminism and the family, one on feminism and spirituality. The first two were quite popular. In the 3 years since her last, she had fallen out of fashion to a degree, and Beverly thought it was something of a relief to her. Her investments had done well. Feminism and capitalism are not mutually exclusive, thank God, she had once told Bev. And now she was a wealthy woman with a townhouse, a place in the country, and two or three lovers virile enough to go the distance with her in the sack, but not quite virile enough to beat her at tennis. When they get that good, I'd drop them at once, she said. And although Kay clearly thought this was a joke, Beverly wondered if it really was. Beverly called a cab, and when it came, she piled into the back with her suitcase, glad to be away from the clerk's eyes, and gave the driver Kay's address. She was waiting at the end of her driveway, wearing her mink coat over a flannel nightgown. Pink fuzzy mules with great big pom-poms were on her feet. Not orange pom-poms, thank God. That might have sent Beverly screaming into the night again. The ride over to Kay's had been weird. Things were coming back to her, memories pouring in so fast and so clearly that it was frightening. She felt as if someone had started up a big bulldozer in her head and begun excavating a metal graveyard she hadn't even known was there. Only it was names instead of bodies that were turning up. Names she hadn't thought of in years. Ben Hanscom, Richie Tozier, Greta Bowie, Henry Bowers, Eddie Kasbrack, Bill Denbro, especially Bill. Stuttering Bill, they had called him, with that openness of children that is sometimes called candor, sometimes cruelty. He had seemed so tall to her, so perfect, until he opened his mouth and started to talk, that was. Names, places, things that had happened. Alternately hot and cold, she had remembered the voices from the drain and the blood. She had screamed and her father had popped her one. Her father, Tom. Tears threatened, and then Kay was paying the cab driver and tipping him big enough to make the startled cabbie exclaim, "Thanks, lady. Wow." Kay took her into the house, got her into the shower, gave her a robe when she got out, made coffee, examined her injuries. McCura chromed her cut foot and put a Band-Aid on it. She poured a generous dollop of brandy into Bev's second cup of coffee and hectored her into drinking every drop. Then she cooked them each a rare strip steak and sautéed fresh mushrooms to go with them. All right, she said. What happened? Do we call the cops or just send you to Reno to do your residency? I can't tell you too much, Beverly said. It would sound too crazy. But it was my fault, mostly. Kay slammed her hand down on the table. It made a sound on the polished mahogany like a small caliber pistol shot. Bev jumped. Don't you say that, Kay said. There was high color in her cheeks, and her brown eyes were blazing. How long have we been friends? 9 years? 10? If I hear you say it was your fault one more time, I'm going to puke. You hear me? I'm just going to fucking puke. It wasn't your fault this time, or last time, or the time before, or any of the times. Don't you know most of your friends thought that sooner or later he'd put you in a body cast, or maybe even kill you? Beverly was looking at her wide-eyed. And that would have been your fault, at least to a degree, for staying there and letting it happen. But now you're gone. Thank God for small favors. But don't you sit there with half of your fingernails ripped off and your foot cut open and belt marks on your shoulders and tell me it was your fault. He didn't use his belt on me, Bev said. The lie was automatic, and so was the deep shame which brought a miserable flush to her cheeks. If you're done with Tom, you ought to be done with the lies as well, Kay said quietly. And she looked at Bev so long and so lovingly that Bev had to drop her eyes. She could taste salt tears in the back of her throat. Who did you think you were fooling? Kay asked, still speaking quietly. She reached across the table and took Bev's hands. The dark glasses, the blouses with high necks and long sleeves. Maybe you fooled a buyer or two, but you can't fool your friends, Bev, not the people who love you. And then Beverly did cry, long and hard, and Kay held her, and later, just before going to bed, she told Kay what she could. Then an old friend from Derry, Maine, where she had grown up, had called and had reminded her of a promise she had made long ago. The time to fulfill the promise had arrived, he said. Would she come? She said she would. Then the trouble with Tom had started.
What was this promise? Kay asked.
Beverly shook her head slowly. I can't tell you that, Kay, much as I'd like to. Kay chewed on this and then nodded.
All right, fair enough. What are you going to do about Tom when you get back from Maine?
And Bev, who had begun to feel more and more that she wouldn't be coming back from Derry ever, said only, I'll come to you first and we'll decide together, okay?
Very much okay, Kay said.
Is that a promise too?
As soon as I'm back, Bev said steadily, you can count on it.
And she hugged Kay hard. With Kay's check cashed and Kay's shoes on her feet, she had taken a Greyhound north to Milwaukee, afraid that Tom might have gone out to O'Hare to look for her. Kay, who had gone with her to the bank and the bus depot, tried to talk her out of it.
O'Hare's lousy with security people, dear, she said. You don't have to worry about him. If he comes near you, what you do is scream your fucking head off.
Beverly shook her head. I want to avoid him altogether. This is the way to do it. Kay looked at her shrewdly.
You're afraid he might talk you out of it, aren't you?
Beverly thought of the seven of them standing in the stream, of Stanley and his piece of broken Coke bottle glinting in the sun. She thought of the thin pain as he cut her palm lightly on a slant. She thought of them clasping hands in a children's circle, promising to come back if it ever started again, to come back and kill it for good.
No, she said. He couldn't talk me out of this.
But he might hurt me, security guards or not. You didn't see him last night, Kay.
I've seen him enough on other occasions, Kay said, her brows drawing together. The asshole that walks like a man.
He was crazy, Bev said. Security guards might not stop him.
This is better, believe me.
All right, Kay said reluctantly, and Bev thought with some amusement that Kay was disappointed that there was going to be no confrontation, no big blow-off.
Cash the check quick, Beverly told her again, before he can think to freeze the accounts. He will, you know.
Sure, Kay said. If he does that, I'll go see the son of a bitch with a horse whip and take it out in trade.
You stay away from him, Beverly said sharply. He's dangerous, Kay, believe me. He was like my father was, what trembled on her lips. Instead, she said, he was like a wild man.
Okay, Kay said. Be easy in your mind, dear. Go keep your promise, and do some thinking about what comes after.
I will, Bev said, but that was a lie. She had too many other things to think about. What had happened the summer she was 11, for instance? Showing Richie Tozier how to make his yo-yo sleep, for instance.
Voices from the drain, for instance. And something she had seen, something so horrible that even then, embracing Kay for the last time by the long silvery side of the grumbling Greyhound bus, her mind would not quite let her see it. Now, as the plane with the duck on the side begins its long descent into the Boston area, her mind turns to that again, and to Stan Uris, and to an unsigned poem that came on a postcard, and the voices, and to those few seconds when she had been eye to eye with something that was perhaps infinite. She looks out the window, looks down, and thinks that Tom's evil is a small and petty thing compared with the evil waiting for her in Derry. If there is a compensation, it is that Bill Denbrough will be there. And there was a time when an 11-year-old girl named Beverly Marsh loved Bill Denbrough. She remembers the postcard with a lovely poem written on the back, and remembers that she once knew who wrote it. She doesn't remember anymore, any more than she remembers exactly what the poem said. But she thinks it might have been Bill. Yes, it might well have been stuttering Bill Denbrough. She thinks suddenly of getting ready for bed the night after Richie and Ben took her to see those two horror movies, after her first date. She had cracked wise with Richie about it. In those days, that had been her defense when she was out on the street. But a part of her had been touched and excited and a little scared. It really had been her first date, even though there had been two boys instead of one. Richie had paid her way and everything, just like a real date. Then afterward, there had been those boys who chased them, and they had spent the rest of the afternoon in the Barrens, and Bill Denbrough had come down with another kid, she couldn't remember who, but she remembered the way Bill's eyes had rested on hers for a moment, and the electric shock she had felt. the shock and a flush that seemed to warm her entire body. She remembers thinking of all these things as she pulled on her nightgown and went into the bathroom to wash her face and brush her teeth. She remembers thinking that it would take her a long time to get to sleep that night, because there was so much to think about. And to think about in a good way, because they seemed like good kids, like kids you could maybe goof with and maybe even trust a little bit. That would be nice. That would be, well, like heaven. And thinking these things, she took her washcloth and leaned over the basin to get some water, and the voice, "Two," came whispering out of the drain.
"Help me."
Beverly drew back, startled, the dry washcloth dropping onto the floor. She shook her head a little, as if to clear it, and then she bent over the basin again and looked curiously at the drain. The bathroom was at the back of their four-room apartment. She could hear, faintly, some Western program going on the TV. When it was over, her father would probably switch over to a baseball game or the fights and then go to sleep in his easy chair. The wallpaper in here was a hideous pattern of frogs on lily pads. It bulged and swayed over the lumpy plaster beneath. It was watermarked in some places, actually peeling away in others. The tub was rust-marked, the toilet seat cracked. One naked 40-watt bulb jutted from a porcelain socket over the basin. Beverly could remember, vaguely, that there had once been a light fixture, but it had been broken some years ago and never replaced. The floor was covered with linoleum from which the pattern had faded, except for a small patch under the sink. Not a very cheery room, but Beverly had used it so long that she no longer noticed what it looked like. The wash basin was also water-stained. The drain was a simple cross-hatched circle about 2 inches in diameter. There had once been a chrome facing, but that was also long gone. A rubber drain plug on a chain was looped nonchalantly over the faucet marked C. The drain hole was pipe dark, and as she leaned over it, she noticed for the first time that there was a faint, unpleasant smell, a slightly fishy smell, coming from the drain. She wrinkled her nose a little in disgust.
"Help me,"
she gasped. It was a voice. She had thought perhaps a rattle in the pipes, or maybe just her imagination, some holdover from those movies.
"Help me, Beverly."
Alternate waves of coldness and warmth swept her. She had taken the rubber band out of her hair, which lay spread across her shoulders in a bright cascade. She could feel the roots trying to stiffen. Unaware that she meant to speak, she bent over the basin again and half-whispered, "Hello? Is someone there?" The voice from the drain had been that of a very young child who had perhaps just learned to talk, and in spite of the goose flesh on her arms, her mind searched for some rational explanation. It was an apartment house. The Marshes lived in the back apartment on the ground floor. There were 4 other apartments. Maybe there was a kid in the building amusing himself by calling into the drain. And some trick of sound.
"Is someone there?"
she asked the drain in the bathroom, louder this time. It suddenly occurred to her that if her father happened to come in just now, he would think her crazy. There was no answer from the drain, but that unpleasant smell seemed stronger. It made her think of the bamboo patch in the barrens and the dump beyond it. It called up images of slow, bitter smokes and black mud that wanted to suck the shoes off your feet. There were no really little kids in the building, that was the thing. The Tremonts had had a boy who was 5 and girls who were 3 and 6 months, but Mr. Tremont had lost his job at the shoe shop on Tracker Avenue. They got behind on the rent, and one day, not long before school let out, they had all just disappeared in Mr. Tremont's rusty old Powerflite Buick. There was Skipper Bolton in the front apartment on the 2nd floor, but Skipper was 14.
"We all want to meet you, Beverly."
Her hand went to her mouth, and her eyes widened in horror. For a moment, just for a moment, she believed she had seen something moving down there. She was suddenly aware that her hair was now hanging over her shoulders in 2 thick sheaves, and that they dangled close, very close, to that drain hole. Some clear instinct made her straighten up quick and get her hair away from there. She looked around. The bathroom door was firmly closed. She could hear the TV faintly, Cheyenne Bodie warning the bad guy to put the gun down before someone got hurt. She was alone. Except, of course, for that voice.
"Who are you?"
she called into the basin, pitching her voice low.
"Matthew Clements," the voice whispered. "The clown took me down here in the pipes and I died, and pretty soon he'll come and take you, Beverly, and Ben Hanscom and Bill Denbro and Eddie."
Her hands flew to her cheeks and clutched them. Her eyes widened, widened, widened. She felt her body growing cold. Now the voice sounded choked and ancient, and still it crawled with corrupted glee.
You float down here with your friends, Beverly. We all float down here. Tell Bill that Georgie says hello. Tell Bill that Georgie misses him, but he'll see him soon. Tell him Georgie will be in the closet some night with a piece of piano wire to stick in his eye. Tell him...
The voice broke up in a series of choking hiccups, and suddenly a bright red bubble backed up the drain and popped, spraying beads of blood on the distained porcelain. The choking voice spoke rapidly now, and as it spoke, it changed. Now it was the young voice of the child she had first heard. Now it was the teenaged girl's voice. Now, horribly, it became the voice of a girl Beverly had known, Veronica Grogan. But Veronica was dead. She had been found dead in a sewer drain.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Betty. I'm Veronica. We're down here.
Down here with the clown, and the creature, and the mummy, and the werewolf. And you, Beverly, we're down here with you, and we float. We change.
A gout of blood suddenly belched from the drain, splattering the sink and the mirror and the wallpaper with its frogs and lily pads pattern. Beverly screamed suddenly and piercingly. She backed away from the sink, struck the door, rebounded, clawed it open, and ran for the living room where her father was just getting to his feet.
What the Sam Hill's wrong with you?
He asked, his brows drawing together. The two of them were here alone this evening. Bev's mom was working the 3-11 shift at Green's Farm, Barry's best restaurant.
The bathroom, she cried hysterically. The bathroom, Daddy, in the bathroom.
Was someone peeking at you, Beverly? Huh? His arm shot out and his hand gripped her arm hard, sinking into the flesh. There was concern on his face, but it was a predatory concern, somehow more frightening than comforting.
No, the sink. In the sink. The...
She burst into hysterical tears before she could say anything more. Her heart was thundering so hard in her chest that she thought it would choke her. Al Marsh thrust her aside with an, "Oh, Jesus Christ, what next?" expression on his face and went into the bathroom. He was in there so long that Beverly became afraid again. Then he bawled, "Beverly, you come here, girl." There was no question of not going. If the two of them had been standing on the edge of a high cliff and he had told her to step off, right now, girl, her instinctive obedience would almost certainly have carried her over the edge before her rational mind could have intervened. The bathroom door was open. There her father stood, a big man who was now losing the auburn hair he had passed on to Beverly. He was still wearing his gray fatigue pants and his gray shirt. He was a janitor at the Derry Home Hospital, and he was looking hard at Beverly. He did not drink, he did not smoke, he did not chase after women.
"I got all the women I need at home,"
he said on occasion, and when he said it, a peculiar secretive smile would cross his face. It did not brighten it, but did quite the opposite. Watching that smile was like watching the shadow of a cloud travel rapidly across a rocky field.
"They take care of me, and when they need it, I take care of them."
"Now just what the Sam Hill is this foolishness all about?" he asked as she came in. Beverly felt as if her throat had been lined with slate. Her heart raced in her chest. She thought that she might vomit soon. There was blood on the mirror running in long drips. There were spots of blood on the light over the sink. She could smell it cooking onto the 40-watt bulb. Blood ran down the porcelain sides of the sink and plopped in fat drops on the linoleum floor.
"Daddy,"
she whispered huskily. He turned, disgusted with her, as he was so often, and began casually to wash his hands in the bloody sink.
"Good God, girl, speak up. You scared hell out of me. Explain yourself, for Lord's sake."
He was washing his hands in the basin. She could see blood staining the gray fabric of his pants where they rubbed against the lip of the sink. And if his forehead touched the mirror, it was close. It would be on his skin. She made a choked noise in her throat. He turned off the water, grabbed a towel on which two fans of blood from the drain had splashed, and began to dry his hands. She watched, near swooning, as he grimed blood into his big knuckles and the lines of his palms. She could see blood under his fingernails like marks of guilt.
"Well, I'm waiting."
He tossed the bloody towel back over the rod. There was blood,
blood everywhere. And her father didn't see it.
"Daddy."
She had no idea what might have come next, but her father interrupted her.
"I worry about you," Al Marsh said. "I don't think you're ever going to grow up, Beverly. You go out running around. You don't do hardly any of the housework around here. You can't cook, you can't sew. Half the time you're off on a cloud someplace with your nose stuck in a book, and the other half you've got vapors and megrims. I worry.
His hand suddenly swung and spatted painfully against her buttocks. She uttered a cry, her eyes fixed on his. There was a tiny stipple of blood caught in his bushy right eyebrow.
If I look at that long enough, I'll just go crazy and none of this will matter, she thought dimly.
I worry a lot, he said, and hit her again, harder, on the arm above the elbow. That arm cried out and then seemed to go to sleep. She would have a spreading yellowish-purple bruise there the next day.
An awful lot, he said, and punched her in the stomach.
He pulled the punch at the last second, and Beverly lost only half of her air. She doubled over, gasping, tears starting in her eyes. Her father looked at her impassively. He shoved his bloody hands in the pockets of his trousers.
You got to grow up, Beverly, he said, and now his voice was kind and forgiving. Isn't that so?
She nodded. Her head throbbed. She cried, but silently. If she sobbed aloud, started what her father called that baby whining, he might go to work on her in earnest. Al Marsh had lived his entire life in Derry and told people who asked, and sometimes those who did not, that he intended to be buried here, hopefully at the age of 110. No reason why I shouldn't live forever, he sometimes told Roger Orlett, who cut his hair once each month. I have no vices.
Now explain yourself, he said, and make it quick.
There was... She swallowed, and it hurt because there was no moisture in her throat, none at all. There was a spider, a big fat black spider. It crawled out of the drain, and I guess it crawled back down.
Oh, he smiled a little at her now, as if pleased by this explanation. Was that it? Damn, if you told me, Beverly, I never would have hit you. All girls are scared of spiders. Sam Hill, why didn't you speak up?
He bent over the drain, and she had to bite her lip to keep from crying out a warning. And some other voice spoke deep inside her, some terrible voice which could not have been a part of her. Surely it was the voice of the devil himself.
Let it get him, if it wants him. Let it pull him down. Good fucking riddance.
She turned away from that voice in horror. To allow such a thought to stay for even a moment in her head would surely damn her to hell. He peered into the eye of the drain, his hands squelched in the blood on the rim of the basin. Beverly fought grimly with her gorge. Her belly ached where her dad had hit her.
Don't see a thing, he said. All these buildings are old, Bev. Got drains the size of freeways, you know it? When I was a janitor in down in the old high school, we used to get drowned rats in the toilet bowls once in a while. It drove the girls crazy.
He laughed fondly at the thought of such female vapors and megrims.
Mostly when the Kanduskeag was high. Less wildlife in the pipes since they put in the new drain system, though.
He put an arm around her and hugged her.
Look, you go to bed and don't think about it anymore, okay?
She felt her love for him. I never hit you when you didn't deserve it, Beverly, he told her once when she had cried out that some punishment had been unfair. And surely that had to be true, because he was capable of love. Sometimes he would spend a whole day with her, showing her how to do things, or just telling her stuff, or walking around town with her. And when he was kind like that, she thought her heart would swell with happiness until it killed her. She loved him and tried to understand that he had to correct her often because it was, as he said, his God-given job.
Daughters, Al Marsh said, need more correction than sons.
He had no sons, and she felt vaguely as if that might be partly her fault as well.
Okay, Daddy, she said, I won't.
They walked into her small bedroom together. Her right arm now ached fiercely from the blow it had taken. She looked back over her shoulder and saw the bloody sink, bloody mirror, bloody wall, bloody floor. The bloody towel her father had used and then hung casually over the rod.
She thought, how can I ever go in there to wash up again? Please, God, dear God, I'm sorry if I had a bad thought about my dad, and you can punish me for it if you want. I deserve to be punished. Make me fall down and hurt myself, or make me have the flu like last winter when I coughed so hard once I threw up. But please, God, make the blood be gone in the morning. Pretty please, God. Okay? Okay?
Her father tucked her in, as he always did, and kissed her forehead. Then he only stood there for a moment in what she would always think of as his way of standing, perhaps of being. Bent slightly forward, hands plunged deep to above the wrist in his pockets, the bright blue eyes in his mournful basset hound's face looking down at her from above. In later years, long after she stopped thinking about Derry at all, She would see a man sitting on the bus or maybe standing on a corner with his dinner bucket in his hand. Shapes, oh, shapes of men, sometimes seen as day closed down, sometimes seen across Water Tower Square in the noonlight of a clear, windy autumn day. Shapes of men, rules of men, desires of men. Or Tom, so like her father when he took off his shirt and stood slightly slumped in front of the bathroom mirror to shave. Shapes of men. "Sometimes I worry about you, Bev," he said, but there was no trouble or anger in his voice now. He touched her hair gently, smoothing it back from her forehead. "The bathroom was full of blood, Daddy," she almost screamed then. "Didn't you see it? It's everywhere. Cooking onto the light over the sink, even. Didn't you see it?" But she kept her silence as he went out and closed the door behind him, filling her room with darkness. She was still awake, still staring into the darkness, when her mother came in at 11:30 and the TV went off. She heard her parents go into their room, and she heard the bed springs creaking steadily as they did their sex act thing. Beverly had overheard Greta Bowie telling Sally Mueller that the sex act thing hurt like fire and no nice girl ever wanted to do it. "At the end of it, the man pees all over your bug," Greta said, and Sally had cried, "Oh, yuck, I'd never let a boy do that to me." If it hurt as badly as Greta said, then Bev's mother kept the hurt to herself. Bev had heard her mom cry out once or twice in a low voice, but it hadn't sounded at all like a pain cry. The slow creak of the spring speeded up to a beat so rapid it was just short of frantic, and then stopped. There was a period of silence, then some low talk, then the sound of her mother's footsteps as she went into the bathroom. Beverly held her breath, waiting for her mother to scream or not. There was no scream, only the sound of water running into the basin. That was followed by some low splashing. Then the water ran out of the basin with its familiar gurgling sound. Her mother was brushing her teeth now. Moments later, the bed springs in her parents' room creaked again as her mom got back into bed. 5 minutes or so after that, her father began to snore. A black fear stole over her heart and closed her throat. She found herself afraid to turn over on her right side, her favorite sleeping position, because she might see something looking in the window at her. So she just lay on her back, stiff as a poker, looking up at the pressed tin ceiling. Sometime later, minutes or hours, there was no way of telling, she fell into a thin, troubled sleep. 3. Beverly always woke up when the alarm went off in her parents' bedroom. You had to be fast because the alarm no more than got started before her father banged it off. She dressed quickly while her father used the bathroom. She paused briefly, as she now almost always did, to look at her chest in the mirror, trying to decide if her breasts had gotten any bigger in the night. She had started getting them late last year. There had been some faint pain at first, but that was gone now. They were extremely small, not much more than spring apples, really, but they were there. It was true. Childhood would end. She would be a woman. She smiled at her reflection and put a hand behind her head, pushing her hair up and sticking her chest out. She giggled a little girl's unaffected giggle and suddenly remembered the blood spewing out of the bathroom drain the night before. The giggle stopped abruptly. She looked at her arm and saw the bruise that had formed there in the night, an ugly stain between her shoulder and elbow, a stain with many discolored fingers. The toilet went with a bang and a flush. Moving quickly, not wanting him to be mad with her this morning, not wanting him to even notice her this morning, Beverly pulled on a pair of jeans and her Derry High School sweatshirt. And then, because it could no longer be put off, she left her room for the bathroom. Her father passed her in the living room on his way back to his room to get dressed. His blue pajama suit flapped loosely around him. He grunted something at her she didn't understand. "Okay, Daddy," she replied nevertheless. She stood in front of the closed bathroom door for a moment, trying to get her mind ready for what she might see inside. At least it's daytime, she thought, and that brought some comfort. Not much, but some. She grasped the doorknob, turned it, and stepped inside. 4. That was a busy morning for Beverly. She got her father his breakfast, orange juice, scrambled eggs, Al Marsh's version of toast, the bread hot but not really toasted at all. He sat at the table, barricaded behind the news, and ate it all. "Where's the bacon?" "Gone, Daddy. We finished it yesterday." "Cook me a hamburger." "There's only a little bit of that left. The paper rustled, then dropped. His blue stare fell on her like weight. "What did you say?" he asked softly. "I said right away, Daddy." He looked at her a moment longer, then the paper went back up and Beverly hurried to the refrigerator to get the meat. She cooked him a hamburger, mashing the little bit of ground meat that was left in the icebox as hard as she could to make it look bigger. He ate it reading the sports page, and Beverly made his lunch, a couple of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, a big piece of cake her mother had brought back from Green's farm last night, a thermos of hot coffee heavily laced with sugar. "You tell your mother I said to get this place cleaned up today," he said, taking his dinner bucket. "It looks like a damn old pigsty. Sam Hill, I spend the whole day cleaning up messes over to the hospital. I don't need to come home to a pigsty. You mind me, Beverly?"
"Okay, Daddy, I will."
He kissed her cheek, gave her a rough hug, and left. As she always did, Beverly went to the window of her room and watched him walk down the street. And as she always did, she felt a sneaking sense of relief when he turned the corner, and hated herself for it. She did the dishes and then took the book she was reading out on the back steps for a while. Lars Theraminius, his long blonde hair glowing with its own serene inner light, toddled over from the next building to show Beverly his new Tonka truck and the new scrapes on his knees. Beverly exclaimed over both. Then her mother was calling her. They changed both beds, washed the floors, and waxed the kitchen linoleum. Her mother did the bathroom floor, for which Beverly was profoundly grateful. Elfrida Marsh was a small woman with graying hair and a grim look. Her lined face told the world that she had been around for a while and intended to stay around a while longer. It also told the world that none of it had been easy, and she did not look for an early change in that state of affairs.
"Will you do the living room windows, Bevy?" she asked, coming back into the kitchen.
She had changed into her waitress uniform.
"I have to go up to St. Joe's in Bangor to see Cheryl Tarrant. She broke her leg last night."
"Yeah, I'll do them," Beverly said.
"What happened to Mrs. Tarrant? Did she fall down or something?"
Cheryl Tarrant was a woman Elfrida worked for at the restaurant.
"She and that no good she's married to were in a car wreck," Beverly's mother said grimly. "He was drinking. You want to thank God in your prayers every night that your father doesn't drink, Bevy."
"I do," Beverly said.
She did. "She's going to lose her job, I guess, and he can't hold one."
Now tones of grim horror crept into Elfrida's voice.
"They'll have to go on the county, I guess."
It was the worst thing Elfrida Marsh could think of. Losing a child or finding out you had cancer didn't hold a candle to it. You could be poor. You could spend your life doing what she called scratching. But at the bottom of everything, below even the gutter, was a time when you might have to go on the county and drink the work sweat from the brows of others as a gift. This, she knew, was the prospect that now faced Cheryl Tarrant.
"Once you got the windows washed and take the trash out, you can go and play a while if you want. It's your father's bowling night, so you won't have to fix his supper. But I want you in before dark. You know why."
"Okay, Mom."
"My God, you're growing up fast," Elfrida said.